Welcome to Burr News Current Affairs Podcast with Jeremy Deacon. Listen at your leisure on www.burrnews.com.
Good afternoon and welcome to this Burr News Facebook Live interview. I'm joined by Shadow Finance Minister and Leader of the Opposition, David Burt. Mr. Burt, thank you again for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
It's always
for
a pleasure.
Agreeing to the interview.
There's been an awful lot happening in the last week to 10 days, and we'll come on to some of those later on in the interview. It would be remiss, though, not to give you an opportunity to talk about your reply to the budget.
What,
if you could summarise it reasonably quickly, what were you trying to achieve? What are you trying to achieve in that budget?
Well, I think the most important thing is that to lay out what the Progressive Labour Party's plan for the economy would be, so voters can have a clear understanding of what the Progressive Labour Party will do when we get into government. And I think that we wanted to lay out what was most important, which was an agenda for growth, and to talk about the initiatives of which we would take in order to ensure that we create growth inside this economy. The challenge which we have is that we need more jobs in Bermuda. We need more jobs from the international sector, we need more jobs in the local sector, and we need more jobs in the tourism sector. And it's just a question of how do we arrive at that point. So we went through a number of measures which speak about our agenda for growth, and we also touched on other issues which we think are important and fundamental.
I did have the opportunity of interviewing the finance minister about his budget, and he did make the point right at the beginning of the interview that you didn't mention the national debt once.
Well, I'm not entirely sure if I did or did not mention the national debt, but this is very similar to an interview of which I had, I would say, yesterday, where they were speaking. And last year in our budget reply, one of the things we said, we led off by saying that when it comes to the issues of the national debt, there is one place where the Progressive Labour Party and the One Bermuda Alliance agree. We may have a difference in policy or on how to achieve the objective, but we both recognize the need that we have to return to a balanced budget as quickly as possible to enable us to start reducing our debt.
Well, I did read your reply, and I don't remember the debt being mentioned there. Was there a particular reason for that, or is it because you've made your policies?
What I would say is that, and if, when you go through writing a reply, there's lots of different things, and this year I ended up speaking for an hour and 40 minutes was my reply, so it was rather long. So there's a lot of things that end up on the cutting room floor. So a lot of times you want to recycle things, which you have from other times because you want to be repetitious, but other times you just have to cut them out, or else you'll end up talking for about two and a half hours. So from that perspective, but as I said, I mean, there are things which we put in our budget replies to 2013, 14, 15, and 2016 especially, where we actually led off in the first section was speaking about the realities. And the realities are that we are constrained. And where I started in that was I said that I don't want the people of Bermuda to believe that the Progressive Labour Party will be able to restore all the cuts which have been made by the One Bermuda Alliance. It's just not possible. But where we disagree is where we spend the resources which we have and where those resources should be directed. We believe that they should be directed towards initiatives that will help to create long-term economic growth.
Come on to that later on, because there is an issue around that, of course. Mm-hmm. But first of all, one of the big ticket items for the last budget was the tax reform to more of a progressive tax. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you agree with? You welcome?
I certainly do. I think that we can support the changes to the tax system, the minor changes which were made from the payroll tax side. The challenge is really it's not so much as the implementation as it is insofar as how does this actually work. And from the perspective of employers, it's going to be something that is going to be incredibly difficult to implement. One of the beauties with our tax system as it is right now, it is a very simple tax system. You're only taxing employers and importers at the same time. Those are the most of the taxes. The other things, that the other revenue that you'll get is from company fees, TCD, user fees, etc. But our tax system is very simplistic. One of the reasons why the government had to delay their taxes is because the implementation of this particular tax reform is going to be incredibly complex for employers. So one of the things which we said during that debate is that the ideas that were mentioned by, perfect example, Craig Simmons, whereas you can achieve the same objective but do it in a different fashion. And what Craig Simmons said is that you can leave the tax system the way that it is and then have targeted tax credits which go to those persons in the various income band levels.
The PLPs, and in your reply to the budget, you mentioned you want to do your own tax reform. Mm-hmm. Is that the kind of thing you're looking at, more tax credits?
Well, the thing that we're looking at is to make the tax system more fair. Mm-hmm. But what's more important than making it more fair is to make sure that Bermuda is competitive going forward. Our system of revenue is basically rooted from an act in 1898, and we're now in 2017. We understand and we see what's happening with Brexit. We understand and we see what's happening with the possible threats from the United States tax reform. And our perspective is what we have to do is we have to have everyone around the table, that's both political parties, international business, local business, hotels, unions, academia, and the law firms, to discuss this challenge and come up with a system which works best for Bermuda, but also, this is key, enhances our competitiveness.
Do you actually think that getting all those people around the table, you get consensus?
You have to get consensus because you have to lead. The fact is that where we are right now is that we are not competitive. The latest increases to payroll tax, which were put in place by the government, we've heard back from the international companies that it will reduce the amount of jobs here in Bermuda. If you are taxing employment, which is what payroll tax is, you are taxing jobs. And when you are taxing jobs, that means that you're more than likely going to have less jobs when you tax them. And I think that is our biggest challenge. We have to design a system that is not taxing jobs, that is looking at getting the revenue which we need from other places and spreading and broadening that tax space, and so that we can actually be more competitive in Bermuda and create jobs. If we were to have, for example, if we were to have 5,000 or 6,000 more jobs here in Bermuda, like we did back at the boom years in 2007 and 2008, we would have more tax revenue and more taxes throughout the country, and I think that's where we want to get to.
So I want you to expand on this quote from your reply to the budget. You said that tax reform and broadening the tax base cannot be effective if they are unwilling to look at taxing the passive income of the privileged persons in society. Can you expand on that?
Absolutely. I think the perfect example of which we gave inside of our reply is that we're talking about the increases in payroll tax, which are going to primarily affect our large insurers.
Are the privileged persons in society.
Well, what I'm saying is, when we look at that, who are the persons who are collecting the rents from those insurers? So the insurers are facing an increased tax burden from the government for payroll tax, which is significant. However, the people who are benefiting from the presence of international business here, perfect example, the landowners that own the land, that have these big commercial properties that are extracting millions of dollars a month in rent, tax-free, where they're, most of them or many of them are not paying mortgages, we have to look at making sure that we can spread that burden across. So why should that burden only fall on the international companies that we want here, which in increasing their taxes make it less likely that they will have more jobs here, or should we look to spread it across the board to see if there are more places where we can get the revenue which is required to balance the budget, make the investments, and create the economic growth of which we want? In my view, I think that those landowners would prefer to have more tenants. And if we need to get to a place where we have more international business here and more jobs here that they can have more tenants, I think that that is a trade-off that when we look at the entire system that they can accept.
One of the criticisms of the finance minister's budget was that a lot of the costs, a lot of the tax increases would be passed down to the consumer.
Absolutely.
In terms of costs.
It's inflationary.
But isn't that exactly what will happen if you tax revenue from rent? Does it increase the rent?
There's a way to do that, but there's lots of different ways where you can design the tax code where those type of things may or may not be able to happen. So I'm not, and now just let me be clear, Jeremy, I'm not an expert in taxes and an expert in tax policy, but I think that's what it comes to a point of leadership. We have to look at everything. There cannot be any no-go areas. If you put everything on the table to come up with a system that in the end makes Bermuda more competitive, I think that's the key point. right now, when we're looking at changes that may be coming in the United Kingdom and the United States, we need to make sure that we have a system that makes us as competitive as possible, which can enable our economic growth, because that's what we need, more jobs.
What's the PLP sort of, if you like, ideology on tax?
Well, again, every time we come, you ask me an ideological question. And I will go, again, to the fact that if there is one place where I am, I'm a pragmatist. It is what works best for Bermuda. If we try to put ourselves in ideological boxes, we're probably not going to get to the place we want to go. We want a tax system that where those who can afford to pay more tax can pay more tax, and a tax system that does not unnecessarily punish those at the lower level, and also one that can lead Bermuda to be a more competitive society and increase jobs that are here.
Going through your reply, there was quite a lot of stuff that was quite old, that's been quite repetitive. Was that deliberate?
Absolutely. I mean, politics, you and I pay attention to politics all the time, but a lot of persons do not pay attention, and they're not listening to the throne speech replies or budget replies or not tuning in. But the also thing is that we're not coming up with new policies. A lot of these policies have been policies that we have researched, that we have enhanced, tweaked a little bit, or from feedback that we get from the private sector partners of which we meet with, whether it be the Chamber of Commerce, ABIC, ABIR, on our union partners, and we are just tweaking and making sure that those are the things that when we get into office, they are already familiar with our plans, they understand what it is that we're looking to do, and they're ready to work with us.
You don't think there's a danger that it looks like you're running out of ideas?
Absolutely not. I mean, the fact of the matter is that if you come with a new idea every year, what happens to the ones that good ideas 2 or 3 or 4 years before? I think that the good ideas we stick with, and those I think is the challenge. It is our plan. So when we talk about Vision 2025, which we came out in 2015, we're not going to move from the tenets of those plans.
One of the areas that I want to talk about is the technology incubator. You mentioned it this year, you mentioned it last year.
Yep. We went more in depth this year than we did last year.
Please expand then.
Well, one of the things that we did is we went in depth in speaking about how it could work. So before we spoke about the basic idea of a technology incubator, we'll have a technology incubator at Southside and to attract companies in the high-tech space. This year we spoke more about how that will work, about making sure that Bermuda is a center for intellectual property. We can have a digital register here, discussing how that area will work, talking about the legislation that needs to fit so we can have mine management and control here, so to make sure that we fall within the international tax requirements, and talking about how that type of industry, and also talking about the funding that is going to be required, making sure that we have a stable of angel investors that will invest in those type of businesses to bring jobs here to Bermuda. I think that everything which you see inside of our agenda for growth talks about increasing the number of jobs that we have here on island.
But in terms of technology incubator, I mean, I'm not very good on technology. Most people I know will tell you that.
Yes.
But what specifically, can you be more specific about the kind of technology you want to see? Mm-hmm. Is it going to be development? Is it going to be basing technology companies here? Mm-hmm. What kind of things? Because technology seems to me that has the it can destroy or can create jobs. Mm-hmm.
Technology is a very wide basis. We know that we see work that's taking place right now in the fintech space. We know that we see work that's taking place in the insurtech space. But, I mean, there's lots of other companies in the world, and we're talking about global companies. So when we're talking about looking to attract companies here to Bermuda, some of the things of which we also have to think about is, what about companies that can use our tax neutral status as a wonderful place to do business and sell your products globally and can move their headquarters here? So it may not even have to be all the development functions, but as we say, the mine management and control that are here inside and the intellectual properties here and the centers of excellence are here, and those persons in the C-suite are here doing that type of work.
So you're probably looking at a small number of high net worth individuals.
Well, right? Absolutely. But I mean, what we must have and our goal in Bermuda must be to create additional jobs. And that was the whole immigration debate, which we went into at length last year. The whole immigration debate is, the discussion is always that we need more people in Bermuda. That's the discussion. Mm. It is something that we agree with. Because all of us, especially those of us who are business owners, want more customers in our stores. We want more people to sell our items to. We want more people inside of the economy to create additional economic activity. The question is not whether or not we need more people here. The question is, how do we get to that point, and what is the best way to do it? It is our view that to incentivize companies to move to Bermuda, to also, and I think this is something that's been used in the private sector, we should not only think about what we could attract, but we should also look what we can use Bermuda as a base to acquire.
It's noticeable in your reply to the budget that there is there are quite a few areas where you will increase funding, increase funding for training and retraining, provide investments for green tech, funding for social enterprises, infrastructure improvements. The obvious question, where are you going to get the money from?
I thought you said you were going to ask that question earlier. Funny. Where we're going to get the money from is efficiencies inside of government, and we speak very at length to talking about efficiencies and how you create those type of efficiencies inside of government, and I think that's something that this government has missed and has not done, and we've seen those complaints that have come from the private sector. When we were in government in 2011 and 2012, we came out with the pre-budget report, and the pre-budget report spoke to the fact that across-the-board cuts do not work. And they actually more than likely make your budget problems worse as opposed to better. What you have to focus on is creating efficiencies inside of government departments. And I gave a specific example of how across-the-board cuts don't work when it comes to tourism. However, insofar as paying and making these type of investments, these are not huge investments. We're talking about increased funding for training and re-education. We're not talking about $30 million like we're spending this year on the America's Cup. We're talking about small amounts of funding that can make a very big difference insofar as making sure we increase the skills that are here on island. And if you look at historically, when you look at the World Bank and other indicators, the best investments that lead to long-term growth are in education and retraining. When we're talking about social enterprise, in my view, if we're talking about a $3 million startup fund for social enterprises, which will get the private sector involved as well, perfect example, everyone saw what happened on Court Street a few days ago. It's these types of social enterprises which are going to be needed to combat the antisocial behavior which we see. So in our view, those are worthwhile investments, because if we don't make those investments, this whole idea of Bermuda being a blue chip jurisdiction, if we don't feel safe, if it's not a safe environment, then we're going to lose that. So I think those investments are needed, but we're not talking about grand scale.
Improvements are quite grand.
Well, infrastructure improvements, that's an excellent one. But infrastructure improvements, I've had meetings with members in the private sector that are looking to actually get together infrastructure funds to use to assist and build infrastructure in Bermuda. Those are the type of things of which you can do if you work in a joint effort, if you are unified, to assist.
Can you just expand on that?
Going to expand any more than that, too.
Because you can't mention which kind of projects, examples.
Infrastructure projects in Bermuda which will assist in our long-term economic growth, because infrastructure assists in long-term economic growth.
I want to move on a little bit because there have been some other issues that have cropped up.
Feel free.
Week to 10 days, perhaps one of the biggest ones is the Commission of Inquiry. Which
it's not the week to 10 days. It's been a very long time.
Time flies. It still is big news and it's still in the headlines. What were your, to coin a phrase I don't particularly like, but what were your takeouts from it?
My takeouts were that it was $1.4 million that could have been spent better. That's my takeaway.
Why?
In the end of the day, we didn't learn much new. I mean, the Commission of Inquiry made a number of recommendations. A number of recommendations which they made were made by the Sage Commission. A number of recommendations which they made were made by the Auditor General already. A number of recommendations which they made were, I mean, the major recommendations that were in there were to support ongoing police investigations. So we support ongoing investigations. So we knew these investigations were taking place before. So from that aspect, when we look at the amount of money that was spent, one must question whether or not it was fully beneficial. What I will say is that when we talk about what new came out of it, I mean, the only thing new really that came out of it was the fact that a sitting One Bermuda Alliance senator was referred for possible criminal activity and a criminal police investigation.
I want to come on to that a bit later on, if I may, but just going back to your general thoughts, it was labeled a witch hunt at the time. Mm-hmm. Do you have any? Do you believe in that?
I absolutely do. I mean, the fact is, if you are concerned about systemic, not necessarily, if you're concerned about systemic issues and working on how to fix the finances, then you're not just going to limit it to the time when your political opponents are in office. You're going to examine everything. You're going to examine the entire gamut. So when you're only doing it from that particular aspect, then yes, it feels like a witch hunt. And that's the thing. We understand, as Sean Crockwell told Parliament the other day, that the Premier didn't even consult his ministers of cabinet before forming this. So clearly it seems as something that was politically motivated or done by a small cabal of people inside the cabinet to extract a political aim. That is the feeling that we have. That is the feeling that many people in society have. That much being said, there were some good recommendations that came out of there that it would be interesting to see if the government who formed this commission of inquiry support. We have to remember how silent they were on many SAGE recommendations that would increase transparency, which are the same ones the commission of inquiry made. The commission of inquiry also made recommendations for campaign finance reform.
I want to come on to those recommendations, some of the finance, because some of them were while the PLP was in office as well. So you're not totally blameless in that respect, if blame's the right word to use. But first of all, there have been suggestions that it might not be tabled in the House. Do you think it should be tabled in the House?
I'll be very clear. We will table it in the House. If the Premier will not table it, we will.
And what do you hope to achieve by that?
We have to have a discussion on the recommendations from the Commission. The Commission of Inquiry recommended that financial instructions be tabled to give them the force of law, which have not been done. It recommended that the Office of Project Managed Procurement be fully staffed, which has not been done. It recommended increased resources for the Public Accounts Committee, which has not been done. It recommended joint select committees to oversee the expenditures of government. Another report for another recommendation, which was carried on from the SAGE Commission, which has not been done. So here we have a government that wants to talk about good governance and wants to have a witch hunt to shine a bad light on their political opponents in whichever way possible. Yet, when faced with recommendations from a commission of which they set up, they do not support the recommendations. Because if they supported the recommendations, then we would have seen the Office of Project Management Procurement fully staffed. We would have seen the code of practice. I asked the Premier during the Cabinet Office debate when we would see financial instructions or a code of practice for procurement. The government is apparently rewriting all procurement legislation, which means that it won't be done in their term of office. That shows you how serious they are. And I think that you wrote a very good article speaking about the things of the Commission of Inquiry and certain questions that need to be asked. Why were the questions about ministerial override taken out of the ministerial code of conduct? These are things that we have to answer, and I think that they deserve a debate in Parliament. And I think that the Premier's refusal to answer that question speaks volumes to the actual original intent of this. The original intent of this was not to get insofar as how do we improve governance in this country. The original intent of this was how can we assist our election campaign with government funding to make our political opponents look bad.
Because, of course, the Premier did use the phrase selective amnesia, excuse me, when I think during a debate with you, and it is a point, that the Good Governance Act was actually brought in under Paula Cox. And you've actually given Paula Cox a lot of credit for this.
Well,
you were a junior finance minister.
Absolutely, but not only us, but the Commission of Inquiry gave them credit as well.
But it started there, and so a lot of these things you've mentioned were not enacted under the PLP either.
What do you mean, the Good Governance Act was enacted under PLP?
Sorry, a lot of the things it recommended were not enacted under you either.
Fair comment. Okay.
So going forward then, I mean, I've got a list of things here. The office you mentioned, the Office of Project Management and Procurement, the OPMP.
We formed that office.
Set up in 2011.
Yes.
And the Commission of Inquiry is still not functioning properly. You do to make function properly?
The first thing is that we will fund it and fill the posts. Right now, it's half-staffed. According to the Good Governance Act, the Office of Project Managed Procurement is responsible for all government procurement. The government didn't even use that office when starting on the airport project, in clear violation of the law. So that's just a point there. And if you're going to be serious about making sure that you have good governance, you have to follow the laws that are in place. So, yes, we will fully staff the Office of Project Managed Procurement. And my background is in project management, IT project management, project management. So I recognize and understand the need and importance for solid project management fundamentals in order to ensure that government projects are managed properly, whether it be large capital projects or small projects, such as the government portal, which we've seen has less information than the old one.
So what kind of priority will you give that? Given, say, you might be in power in less than a year's time, what priority will you give that?
Full priority. The office must be staffed. The one thing that when I go to meetings with international business leaders, when I go on the doorsteps, when I go everywhere, the Progressive Labour Party is a party that has a history of improving the standard of governance in this country. I can run down the list, but you already know what it is. When we talk about the Office of Project Management Procurement, good governance, the Office of the Ombudsman, strengthening independence of the Office of the Auditor General, all those items which were done by the Progressive Labor Party. We have a long history of putting forward those types of improvements, and we have a robust good governance platform. And what we will do, as opposed to just talk the good game before the election, the pledge of which I have made to the electorate is that we will put those things in place. But we also have to understand that those things are not the main items that will affect and change the lives of people in this country.
The 2011 Good Governance legislation also allowed for breaches of financial regulations to be made a criminal offence. That hasn't been invoked, will you?
Yes.
Unequivocally?
Yes. We will table financial instructions. We can't. I do not believe...
Well, the legislation's there. It just hasn't been invoked.
As I said, all the Minister of Finance has to do is print financial instructions and put them on the table. That's all he has to do. We've had this conversation. This is not the first time we've discussed it in an interview with you and I, and we've had this discussion many times. For whatever reason, the government does not want to do that.
There's nothing in financial instructions that covers PPPs.
But there's something that is in the new code of practice for procurement management, the draft code of practice, which has been through multiple drafts, which the Commission of Inquiry urged to be published and to be used. And when I asked the question during the debate to the Premier, the Premier says they are writing entirely new procurement legislation, so there is not going to be any code of practice that will have the force of law.
Well, the Commission didn't talk about a code of practice so much. He says there appears to be no express provision or provisions in financial instructions that address proposed public-private partnerships.
Correct. However, what I'm saying is that the code of practice for procurement and project management, which was mentioned by the Commission of Inquiry, who stated that it has been so long in coming into effect. The draft regulations, which the Premier had put out on the website a year after he said that they were actually going to put up, mention PPP specifically.
And one other recommendation from the COI, and I want to know if you support this as well, he says, we would also endorse the Auditor General's recommendation of an oversight committee on the retention of consultants, whether individuals, foreign or local, as well as companies.
I would take a look at that. I'm not going to say yes or no. I think that whenever you have an oversight committee, I don't think there's such a thing as too much oversight. And as long as it's set up in a way that is structured, then I'm fine. One of the conversations that I was having with various people, under Progressive Labor Party government, there may be times where the cabinet disagrees with the recommendation of cabinet of technical officers. That is the right of the cabinet as the elected government of the day. What we just need to do is that we need to make sure that we clearly document and explain the reasons why, bring those to Parliament, and accept the scrutiny of which it requires. That's it. I personally believe that if you are completely open and honest and actually explain the rationale for the reasons in which you do things, I happen to believe that the people of the country and the voters of the country will respect that.
In terms of the Public Accounts Committee, I get the impression from the Commission's report that they thought perhaps the PAC could do more.
Absolutely.
How could he do more? You were chairman for a very long
Absolutely.
Time.
Absolutely. What is required is...
Because at the moment, that's really the only committee that has oversight, isn't it?
It is. And it's the only oversight committee that operates. We believe, like the SAGE Commission, that we should have more oversight committees. But it is the only oversight committee that operates. And it has absolutely no resources whatsoever. I mean, it doesn't even... There are smaller parliaments that have more resources for their public accounts committee. There is no resource. There's no full-time resource. There's nothing. So... Perfect example, in the United Kingdom, the chairman of the Public Accounts Committee doesn't write reports. Here, we have to write the report. Now, that's not to say that there's an excuse about whether or not a report can be written or not. The fact is that when you are a part-time minister, you have other things to do, other responsibilities, it becomes difficult to schedule that time in to make sure those reports are written. So we have to write the reports, we have to do the investigation. A perfect example is when we had the Port Royal report. We had Port Royal. We went to the Auditor General to request information. We asked the Auditor General, can you please turn over the information which you have? The Auditor General said, no, we can't turn over the information. You have to request the information yourself. So we request the information. We got thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of stuff. So now here you have to, again, read through what's already been read through, all these different pages. The fact is that if you have full-time staff that is assigned to committees, those are the type of things that can be done, can be summarized, so parliamentarians can focus on the main items and can do more reports. That's the thing that's necessary. I don't want to get into the whole thing about, you know, the time and the whole reports and being taken, but if you want to be able to have oversight over more items, you need to make sure you provide the resources.
So will you, if you're Premier?
Absolutely.
What will you do for the PAC then? What kind of steps would you take to give it more power, give it more authority?
Well, I can read to you from our throne speech reply, and which spoke about what we will take insofar as good governance. And when we spoke to the Public Accounts Committee specifically, what we said is, Mr. Speaker, the next PLP government will also ensure that funding is made available so a full-time staff member can be appointed to the Public Accounts Committee. That's it.
But would
they can do more work.
Would you give it any more power?
The Public Accounts Committee has all the power that it requires currently under Parliament. It does. I mean, it has the power to send for
papers. Is that being used properly then?
Well, it's being used. Whether or not the government responds, as we seen, as we saw with the airport project, the government did not respond. But in my view, I think it is being used properly. But the thing is that we have to, again, remember that with the limited resources which we have, it becomes a challenge insofar as doing this. Right now, especially if you look during the budget session, we have the Parliament staff, which is short-staffed as well. We have the committee. We have the Parliament, which is short staff, and then we have the committee who has to go through the Parliament staff, because committee members aren't supposed to directly communicate with ministers. You have to send something through a minister, so they have to go in. So from you have to send something to the clerk. The clerk has to send it to the permanent secretary. Then you have to wait for the response to go back. All I'm saying is that that process could be more efficient if there were full-time and dedicated resources to the Public Accounts Committee. But in the budget session, the assistants to the clerk of the legislature are in the session. They have the Senate. They have lots of other things. So it's just a question of timing and resources.
The other major issue that's happened recently is the resignation from the OBA, Mark Pettingham.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly now he's sitting as an independent MP alongside Sean Crockwell.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think realistically you could actually force a motion of no confidence in the government now?
The only thing that I would say is that if we believe that the majority of members in the House of Parliament will support a motion of no confidence, we will table it.
Have you had discussions?
I wouldn't say that we've had any meaningful discussions.
Messrs. Pettingill and Crockwell.
I have spoken with Mr. Pettingill and Mr. Crockwell. I think we spoke last Friday or last Monday, and we're just discussing things because I wanted to discuss with them the way in which they felt regarding the various amendments that we're going to be doing for customs duty and other things. So when it comes to talk about legislation, now that they're independent members, certainly we have discussions with them to see what type of support they may offer for any amendments that we will be looking to put forward.
What's the relationship like from the PLP's point of view now with the Speaker, Randolph Horton?
I mean, the Speaker is the Speaker of the House, and he'll be the Speaker of the House until the next election.
Just explain the... Can you, for the viewers, mm-hmm. The way the Speaker's role works in terms of a vote?
In terms of what vote?
A vote, any vote in
that. The Speaker doesn't vote. The Speaker doesn't vote. I mean, it is no surprise that it is an incredible bone of contention within members of the Progressive Labour Party that Randy Horton, a longtime Progressive Labour Party member of Parliament in one of the safest PLP seats in the entire country, is basically the only reason why the One Bermuda Alliance is still the government. Because if he were sitting in our seats, the government would collapse. But those are the nature. I mean, those are the facts.
So would you like to see him relinquish that post?
I would certainly love and welcome any point in time the Speaker of the House wished to say that he no longer wished to be Speaker and would like to rejoin the PLP benches.
And have you asked him to do that?
Absolutely. There's been many discussions with that, but I do not, as I said, I believe the Speaker of the House will be the Speaker of the House until the next election.
Just a couple of other things. Well, probably the last thing I really want to talk to you in detail mm-hmm. about is the America's Cup is just a few weeks away.
Mm-hmm.
You were fairly scathing, I think. My phrase, obviously you agree or disagree with it, in the budget reply. You were saying that when we take issues at the One Bermuda Alliance's consistent refusal to acknowledge the event for what it has been and what it is, an event that appeals to a narrow segment of society. Can you just expand on what you mean by that?
It's sailing. I mean, sailing is not a broad sort of sport. It's not like football. It is what it is. I mean, it's sailing. It's a rich, especially when we're talking about the America's Cup. I mean, it's a rich man's sport, and that's the nature of it. So, I mean, that those are the facts.
But is there an implication there? Am I reading too much into it that you feel that the society as a whole isn't going to benefit or isn't benefiting?
I think that it's clear that society as a whole is not going to benefit as much as it should. I mean, when all is said and done, we're going to possibly have invested $110 million of taxpayer funds in order to ensure that this America's Cup happens. And that's between the money that we spend directly for the America's Cup and the money of which we spent on Cross Island. In order to build the base, to ensure build the team site, to ensure that this event will take place. So when you're talking about that amount of money being spent, and the projections for the return to the government from this whole thing is only $50 million, then clearly there's a very large gap. Now we hear about, you know, the additional economic benefit which may happen inside the economy, and that's a fact, that's fair. But when you look at the persons who are going to get those benefits aren't necessarily going to go to the man on the street in large instance. Those are going to go to the large importers, Butterfield and Dallas, Goslings, the people who can afford to be sponsors and make sure that they have all their things in the event. So when you look at it from that perspective, and I think that it's very clear, as you see with the last minute scramble of the One Bermuda Alliance in this thing yesterday, where they're now all of a sudden giving microloans and expanding their microloan program in support of America's Cup businesses 2 months before this event was taking place. Our view is, if you've known that this event has been taking place in Bermuda since 2014, you should certainly have been doing a lot more to make sure that you're prepared and to make sure that the benefits are spread as widely as possible before doing last-minute things 2 months before the event.
Given that, okay. Mm-hmm. But the America's Cup is the start of something, perhaps.
Okay.
The start of something. I'm asking your opinion. This is the start of something that could help to reinvigorate, say, the tourism economy, to small business economy, etc. Isn't there going to be a longer-term benefit that you would support out of this?
There will be many people that have argued that there will be a longer-term benefit, and I'm not going to say yes or no. I prefer to take a wait-and-see approach. What I can say is that we have spent when it's all said and done, we'll have spent $110 million investing in the America's Cup. And the fact is, whether or not the return will be what it should be. Those are just the facts. I can't speak to yes. I can't speak to no. What I can say is that in a future Progressive Labour Party government, we will make sure, because I'm sure if the New Zealand team doesn't win and if they want to have it here again, the structure will be to ensure that the way that it is set up to make sure that it benefits a larger segment of society than just those who may be privileged enough to have the funds and the corporate people to go ahead and sponsor and ensure that they are the prime suppliers. Because right now, it's importers, restaurants, people who supply boats, and people who sell gas. Those are the main people that
but
are
But you will bring the America's Cup back if you're in power.
We will
support
what I will say is we will analyze it, we will have those negotiations, and we'll make a decision that is in the best interest of the country.
So you might not?
I can't speak to that. I can say that when we look at it, it would be foolish for me right now, Jeremy, to say yes or no without analyzing what the effect is. We haven't even had the America's Cup. You understand what I'm saying? We have not had it yet. So having those type of discussions and prognostications of what may or may not be, I don't think that's wise. And that's not the trap that I'm going to fall into as a prospective future leader of the country.
On that note, Mr. Burt, thank you very much for your time.
All done?
All done.
Thank you for tuning in to Burr News Current Affairs Podcast with Jeremy Deacon. Listen at your leisure on www.burrnews.com, your 24/7 Bermuda news source.